this week on The Inside Flap.
And the fact was is that FDR, historically, was nearly assassinated once and also survived a nonviolent coup that was intending to replace him with a military leader. And that coup was basically folded up and swept away and dealt with very privately in the corridors of power, but it allegedly involved some of the, you know, biggest names in American industry. I mean, this was a president who had enemies, and I thought, you know, I'm going to use that and I'm going to fictionalize a threat to his life that is going to happen while Mila is on American soil. Because really, if you're going to make an attempt on a president's life, don't you do it when there's a Russian sniper in town?
So I get to go to the left. I'm going to the left, and the guy's screaming at me, 10 milers. He's screaming 10 milers to the right, 10 milers to the right.
Oh, no.
So I stop and I said, where's the 10 mile finish? And the guy looks at me. And so I just start going to my right because he's pointing and saying 10 miles. And then I hear, David, no! David, no!
Is that your mom?
And it's my mom. And it's Julia, my niece. Julia comes running up to me, flying up to me. No, this way. Oh, he's wrong.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Sitting across the room to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And to my left, on the other side of Charlie the English Bulldog, is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior,
thank you for joining us. This is episode 163 of
The Inside Flap Podcast.
We got a great show for you today. We're joined by Kate Quinn, the New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of historical fiction, including The Huntress and The Rose Code. Her new historical historical fiction book out now is called The Diamond Eye, which is very timely as it tells the true tale of a Ukrainian woman who became a famous sniper during World War II. Had a great chat with Kate, and we'll have that for you in just a little bit, along with our book recommendations and the
audiobook of the week.
But first, I want to tell you guys about my spring break. Now, you all heard about Laura's spring break down to New Orleans, taken before mine. It just really is unfortunate that Sylvia's spring break, it does not happen at the same time.
Oh, get
as
this.
Mine.
If this makes you feel any better,
okay.
I have a client who has one kid in DPS,
yes,
and the other kid is in JeffCo.
Okay.
And so,
that's the same as
weird
our situation.
Vacations, you know. Yeah, but it's the child. Like, you can't even take the children. You have to split it up, and then one kid ended up getting, and the other one didn't, basically.
That's tough.
Yeah, Andrew.
And so for spring break, that's both the best and the worst thing about spring break.
Yeah.
Well, and the reason I say that is, one of the reasons you can go on spring break and have a nice vacation is because people have their breaks at different times.
True. That's
right?
True.
If you go at Christmas or some of these other holidays, everybody's trying to stay at the same place in the same time.
It helps stagger the crowds.
Yeah, it does. And it was great today hearing my students tell me all about where they went, England, Costa Rica, all these places, New York. And I was like, I went down to Tucson.
Aww.
But it was good to see my parents, of course, Mary and George.
Yeah, hello.
Tucson's nice.
Yeah, Tucson is very nice.
Beautiful.
And in fact, I had a wonderful race down there, which listeners, you'll be happy to know, as after hearing about the Code Brown experience I had on my last race, where I spent half my time in a porta potty and the other half running. Oh, and don't forget the time spent in the prairie grass, a clump of prairie grass on the side of the road. This time went much smoother, signed up for a... Now, it's funny because before, a couple of months ago, when I was planning the trip out, and I messaged my brother-in-law, John, my sister's husband, John. He likes to run, too. I said, hey, I'm coming down. You want to do a race with me? He's like, oh, sure, sure. Great. Sign us up. I said, well, there are two options for this race. There's a 5-mile loop or there's a 10-mile option where you run it
I'm curious.
Two times.
What did John say?
John said, whatever you want to do.
Ooh.
Literally said, you know the punchline of this.
Yeah.
He told me whatever you want to do.
So he's saying, bring it on, Matt. I can
handle it. That's right.
Yeah.
And he's 10 years younger than me.
So I said,
all right, John, I'm going to sign us up for the 10. It was actually 10 and a half. About it turned out to be 10.3 miles, but whatever. So I signed us both up. So I get down there, and we were looking at the results from previous years. And like the winner from last year was running over 7-minute miles. And we're both like, well, in a race, we could do 7-minute miles. We could win.
We could win.
And we're like,
were you thinking you would be brother and brother-in-law, two brothers just running across the line?
And we went out the day before for an easy 4-mile jog.
Feeling like champions
we
already.
We ran together with the dog, with Ruby the dog. We ran nice and easy.
Were you guys thinking, like, we've got this?
Yes.
Like giving each other knowing nods?
Yeah, and we're making little jokes like, hey, look, hey, I'm going to push you off to the side when we hit the canyon to mile 9, and I'm going to cross the finish line first. And he's like, no, I'm going to fit, you know, I'm going to trip you when we, like, okay,
going
back and forth, looking at the times.
If it was two women, we would have been talking about linking arms and crying going over the.
That's true. No, we're talking about throwing each other to the ground face first in the sand. And the sand is something I should mention, because one thing we did not really think about is that this race is not on the road. It's running on the road is one thing. This is at Catalina State Park, for those of you who know Tucson. And this park and this race turned out to be hot, for one. It was sandy, for two. And it was, oh, by the way, very hilly, with almost 1,000 feet of elevation gain. So we took off, and John actually walked. He walked the first mile when we got there. We got there like a half an hour early. He's like, all right, let's go walk the course. I'm like, no, I'm sitting in the car. You go ahead and do what you got to do. It was a little chilly at the beginning.
Yeah.
It got very hot very quickly, but at, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, as the race is at 7, it's a little chilly.
Yeah, it's a desert, so it's cold.
Yeah,
exactly. He's like, well, I'm gonna walk the first mile. So go ahead, knock yourself out. And he did, and he came back. He's like, all right, this is doable. Little hilly.
Oh, no.
This is doable. I said, great.
So you guys are still thinking, like, 7-minute miles,
we've
got this?
We are scoping everybody out. He's like, listen, there's one guy. He's tall. He's skinny. I think he's our competition.
Oh, no.
I think he's our
competition. Was he your competition?
And it turned out, not only was he our competition, he turned out to be the winner.
Oh,
so
yeah. John did pick out
pick out the winner. And there were 104 people.
Was it the guy
people.
Without the shirt on that was at the start?
No, you saw the picture of that guy. No, it wasn't that guy. This guy was a gazelle. This guy ran it in 6 minutes and
Whoa.
4 seconds per mile flat. This guy was flat out flying. I don't know. He was in his 20s.
That's impressive.
He was flying.
Wow.
So we get over to the starting line. And I actually ended up in a porta potty line for too long. And as I get out of the porta potty, the national anthem has already started. And I had to kind of scurry over to the start. I started going over there, and everyone's just standing still. So I had to stop and stand still and wait. I get over there. John's got his big, he runs with his big headphones.
His Dre.
What?
His Beats,
yeah,
his
he
Beats
does.
By Dre.
He runs with his Beats by Dre, not unlike the headphones we're wearing right now. I put in my little, AirPods. And
John he had a fluorescent yellow green,
bright green, lime green shirt,
tank top,
lime green, lime green
tank top. Easy to spot,
top,
yeah, easy to spot easy in to the spot. Photos, the race photos.
Yeah, he is. And we'll post, and I say this a lot, and sometimes I forget, but I'm here to tell you right now, if you go to theinsideflap.com and look at this episode, the top one, episode 163, I'll post a couple of shots from the race for you.
So I had friends that looked at like the website this week.
Oh.
Oh,
and they
really?
Saw the picture of me with the cat and the dog basically in my lap.
Yes, yeah, that's right.
And they really liked that
there
picture.
There you go, yeah. So we'll continue to give you content, because that's what we do here on the Inside Flap. We give and we give and we give. But anyway, so the race, the gun goes off for the race. Not a gun. I think they just count
starter
me down.
Starter pistol.
But the interesting thing was that where the mats are, when you have your time by an electronic chip on your bib, and they go off when you cross the little mats there, nobody was up at the mats. We were all hanging back, and everybody's looking at everybody else, and it was like a slow walk up. He said, 3, 2, 1, go, and it was like a slow walk up to the mats. It was interesting. I'd never seen anything like it, but for some reason, it was kind of a low-key affair. There were about 100 people running the 10-miler, and then the 5-miler was going to start after, like 15 minutes after the 10-miler or whenever. So the gun goes off, and it starts out like straight uphill. This is a very steep, like it's steeper than some steps.
Is this what John had called a little hilly?
This is what John, now when John was walking it, now we're running it.
Oh.
And we're running at, I'm going out at a pretty good clip. John is right behind me because I can see out of the corner of my eye, the bright green fluorescent. And he's huffing, he's puffing. We're both huffing and puffing, to be honest with you, as we go up probably about 200 yards, 250 yards was how long this hill is, but incredibly steep, and it's right at the beginning. And you know it's a trail marathon, so you're kind of in the back of your mind, you're thinking you don't want to get caught behind people, and you want to stay out of people's way.
Yeah.
So we go straight up, and we get going, and then I'm trying to catch my. We get up the hill, we take, and I'm now at this point, even coming from elevation, and I've been running a lot. I'm trying to catch my breath. I don't know what shape John is in as far as behind me. And I do know we come around the corner and I immediately see a race photographer. So I just start doing the thumbs up and double guns, you know, smiling for the photographers. That's what I like to do. It's great. Anytime you can make the photographers laugh. That's a good sign. And they're clicking away and they're laughing as I'm giving them the big smile, big goofy smile and big double gun points. So we get out the first mile, and then there comes a point in the course where you go, you're literally hit the beach. There's about a half mile, and it's like running on a sandy beach, and it's tough. It is really, really tough. And again, I'm running probably about 7:15, 7:20 pace, hitting the sand, and the first guy was way off. And then there were two guys, so I knew I was in fourth place at this point. I couldn't look around to see where John was. So we go up, and then we come up, and then we hit a flight of stairs, and then there's an out and back. We go like out a half a mile, and you turn around. And here was, now this was very technical, the way they showed you where you turn around. They had a stick on the ground, and a guy standing there in the middle of the trail, and the guy standing there, all right, run around the stick. It's like the stick that's like 3 feet long. And just lying there on the ground in the middle of the trail, and the guy saying, run around the stick. Not like planted in the ground, just lying flat on the ground.
Did you do an extra loop around the stick?
I should have. I ran around the stick, and I don't see John. So I know I've dropped him. This is about mile 2.5 out of the first 5-mile loop. And I run down the trail, down, 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 as other people are approaching it. And finally, I see John. His face is a beat lobster red face, and he looks absolutely miserable. He's given me a look like, why did you sign me up for this?
Yeah.
He gave me the old throat slashing moment, like, cut, I'm out of here. I've had enough of this. I just gave him like a little shrug, like, oops, sorry. I don't know what to tell you. Kept going, and then finished the first lap. And I felt really good. It was one of the rare races where everything seemed to go as planned, and I was hitting my paces. Everything was good. By the second lap, you're intermingled. Now I'm starting to lap the 10-milers who are still on the first lap, and then you've got the 5-milers in there too. And a lot of people are just, I guess, just walking it, especially on the uphill parts, because I had to constantly scream out, "On your left, on your left." And then I'm going down one stretch, and I screamed at this guy who's like literally walking next to a woman down the trail. I screamed, "On your left." Well, he goes to his left, and I end up like giving him a huge bear hug as I run directly into That's him. Funny. And the woman he was with was screaming, "I told you to watch out. I told you." She's yelling at him, not me. I think she's yelling at him. I don't know. Maybe she's yelling at him. But I was like, "Sorry, sorry."
I can get panicked in situations like that. Shocker.
Yeah.
And I will sometimes do, if I hear a directive, I will do that directive.
Yeah. And that's true, because that's all you hear. Instead of on your left, you know, to your left. But ran into him, but that was fine.
Ended if someone up, said to your left, I would not know what to do.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I would freeze in indecision. What are you supposed to do if someone says to your left?
No, on your left. So if you hear someone shouting at you on your left,
I get it. Oh, and I'm
that's
two,
what
I'm,
that's
two?
What I was shouting.
Yeah, that's on fine. Your left. Yeah, but I'm just saying, you hear the direction, you're gonna jump that
right,
way.
Right. Yeah. Not unlike. Remember, we were on a trail once hiking, and we had the worst case. I mean, this guy was the biggest jerk ever. With the guy on the bike, the mountain bike, screaming down, coming in hot, look out. And we had to jump off the trail.
Well, it wouldn't have been a problem if it was just the two of us, but we had, Sylvia was a small child, and we had Nelson, a big dog. So it was hard to corral.
It really was.
Yeah.
But then, so I there was a guy behind me. I ended up pulling past him because I didn't want him to pass me. So I knew I had fourth place. And I'm coming down towards the finish, and just right where you get to, right before the finish, if you look to your left, you see the finish line, and then to the right is you go, the 5 milers go for, or the 10 milers go in their second loop, and there's a guy standing there, and at this point, there's 5 milers who are finishing, because they only run the one lap, and 10 milers who are going off for their second lap.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, here I am, I'm in fourth place, and I need to finish my 10-mile race. So I get to go to the left. I'm going to the left, and the guy's screaming at me, 10 milers. He's screaming, 10 milers to the right, 10 milers to the right.
Oh, no.
So I stop, and I said, where's the 10-mile finish? And the guy looks at me. And so I just start going to my right because he's saying, he's pointing and saying 10 miles. And then I hear, David, no! David, no!
Your mom?
And it's my mom, and it's Julia, my niece. Julia comes running up to me, flying up to me. No, this way. He's wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Trust me.
Thank you,
Mary.
Trust
me.
I would have been screaming bloody murder.
Thank you, Mary. And thank you, Julia. And she got me on track. And she actually, it was great. She ran the last 100 yards, 200 yards, or whatever, to the finish line.
Julia did, not your mom.
Julia did, not my mom.
Well, your mom could.
And finished with me.
I'm just glad that you got that correction. Because had you not, your mom would have been over there beating the crap out of the guy.
That's true, definitely.
Now, David.
Yeah. Mary is a former teacher.
Oh, yeah.
And she's got some pipes.
Yeah.
When she wants to use them, she can use them.
Definitely.
And a Baltimore accent to boot.
Interesting post-race as it was almost pushing 90 degrees out in the hot sun.
Oh.
And the post-race meal was refried beans and scrambled eggs.
Ooh.
Not something you want.
No.
A post race.
No.
It was kind of weird.
So how did John finish?
John
He
finished 27th place out of 104, so he did just fine. And
he stuck with it. Yep.
Yeah, good for him for finishing.
After he finished the first lap, and I saw my parents too at the end of the first lap, they had gotten there in time. He stopped and he said he was going to quit. But my sister, his wife, Kate, had to talk him into finishing. Yeah.
Aww.
I guess Julie did too.
I would have wanted to quit too.
You can do it. He wanted to quit.
I don't blame you, John.
But good for him for sticking it out and keep going.
If I'd been running with John, I would have convinced him to quit.
You would have.
Yeah.
You would have. But, you know, it's been tough traveling for him. I know he's going back and forth across the country for his work. So he gutted it out and finished quite well. Quite well.
I couldn't have done that.
Mm-hmm. But a good experience and a lot of fun. The Catalina, and I'll post those pictures for you guys on theinsideflap.com. So check it out. Laura, how has your week been?
I am struggling. So I have my own business, and I'm an interior designer.
Well, go ahead and give your business a little plug right off.
Laura Medicus.
Not that you need it, but
Laura Medicus Interiors.com.
Laura Medicus
Interiors.com.
That's right. So, how do I say this? When you go to a design school, you never ever are required or encouraged to take like a business class or an entrepreneur class.
Right.
There's no talk of you ever owning your own business or ever doing anything businessy. It's all like theoretical design.
Right.
And did you want to say something, Andrew?
No, not yet.
Oh,
not yet.
Okay.
Yeah. The business mind over here to my left is letting it simmer.
It's not my strong suit. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty good at marketing. I enjoy marketing. That's a strong suit in terms of business, if we're going to talk business. Mm-hmm. Everything else business related, I'm terrible at. Absolutely terrible at.
Right.
So I've had with me throughout my whole ownership of a business, I've always had a bookkeeper.
And how long have you owned this business?
For 10 years.
10 years.
So I've always had a bookkeeper.
Right.
And because I know I cannot do that at all. Like, just don't trust me with that. Mm-hmm. And they've been great. And they've helped me through the years with different business decisions. Like, you should raise your rates.
Yeah, you never just say, they're always telling you to raise your rates.
They are. My mom does too. Yeah. You know, and her, she's an MBA. So I have other people who are businessy that tell me to do these things. Mm-hmm. In a million years, I don't think about it, which is to my detriment. Mm-hmm. So, recently I didn't like, I've been slammed with work, right? Slammed yeah. for a long time.
Busy.
Doing it all myself. And then I've been listening. I don't know, like, what do I hire first? I don't know. I'm a dumb designer. I don't know who to hire first. So I've been listening to business podcasts. And they're like, hey,
get your information from, oh, well, hold
interior on, design we're doing a business, podcast. Interior design business podcast.
Yeah.
And they're like, the first thing you should hire is not another designer. You should hire an assistant after you've hired the bookkeeper, of course, which everyone says.
Right. Should. Okay.
So last year I hired an office assistant, like an executive assistant, really. And I wish I'd hired her earlier. It was fantastic. It changed the way I work.
Yes. You were very happy.
It made me happier with everything. It was fantastic. And then I was like, okay, I also need a designer. So then in January or maybe December, I hired a part-time designer. And so that's great. But I'm still completely floundering with, like, I don't know how other people do it. I don't know how you set about, because I look at other peers and they've got like a team of 7 working for them and all this stuff. And it's like, how on earth do you know how to do that? And so I'm just saying out there, they need to offer like entrepreneur classes to people and encourage younger interior designers or older, if you went back for a career change, to like, hey, take some business classes if you think you may want to own your own business someday.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that's changed. But, you know, the question is, have you tried getting in touch with your alma mater and basically asking them specifically?
No, that's a good idea.
You know, you guys really need...
Yeah.
You really need to do this. You
Florida
know?
State University.
Yep. That's right. Florida State. Mm-hmm. Go Noles.
Go Noles. Yeah. And so it's one of those things.
Oh. So sorry. You hit the the alarm, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
When you say
but
that.
But it is something where, like, I feel like I'm pretty competent at my job. Like, I've been doing it a long time. I know what I'm doing.
More than competent.
Yeah,
you're great at your job.
I'm skilled at my job.
Yes.
And so for some reason in my head, I'm like, oh, I'm skilled at owning a business. I'm not. And I'm just now realizing, like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't like thinking about the business stuff.
No.
And I just need I almost need a business mentor to be like, hey, this is what your goals should be. Or don't spend this on this yet. Wait a little bit.
So one of the things, you know, you're learning like in business is doing things efficiently.
Yeah.
Right. And times management. I mean, just like when stuff gets done.
Yeah.
But I would say for a manager, one of the most important skills to learn is delegating.
Right. And that is not easy. And I have worked in, it's been a very long time. The biggest office I've ever worked in was like 100 and something. And that was a very long time ago. That was like 2002, 2003.
Yeah.
And ever since then, I've worked in small firms and then had my own. And so I haven't had a lot of experience delegating at all, Andrew. And so that has been very difficult because I realize, oh, I got to keep a plate spinning. You know?
Well, and part of it too is if you're running your own business, you're doing your own thing, you're doing everything.
Everything.
Well, delegation means letting go.
Yeah, it does. It does. And trusting also. And knowing like, if they mess up, it's okay. I can help them learn how to do it better or we can talk about it.
Yeah. It's a process. It is. Yeah.
It's hard though. It's so hard. And it's just like different little things. And I just don't know how people jump from, and I guess it seems like some people will take a firm and then all of a sudden they've got like 7 people working for them. It's like, how do you know how to do that? How to do that? Mm-hmm. But, and you're working for a startup now, Andrew, which that's gotta be kind of interesting, right? To see stuff from the ground up.
Well, I've worked for small companies before, you know, but generally I'm working for a pretty nice group of people. And I should say this athletic geriatric dog just literally looped like 3 feet over
The dogs are shoved. They're playing musical chairs up here on the couch. As Nelson has now jumped up right over Andrew's legs.
Yeah, he
realizes Charlie was way too comfortable on the couch. So
he's taking the alpha dog position as Charlie is down below staring up.
True. You've been demoted, Charlie.
Yeah.
Sorry, buddy. but, you know, it's... And so I take the approach where it really comes down to, it's like cooking. It's making sure you've got all the ingredients and that, you know, everything's getting, you know, that you've got all the ingredients to make the recipe, right? That's the first thing, mm-hmm. right? And then it's basically doing it in the right order. But, you know, I work with my team and I'm kind of like, well, you know, I want to enable you. Mm-hmm. Let me know what you need. But one of the things when it comes to delegating is letting go a little bit.
Yeah.
Right? And basically, look, you know,
That's one of the biggest things, I think, too.
The other thing that I do is I basically tell them, look, you can ask me anything. Like, if you don't like something or don't, you know, disagree, you know, I have no ego when it comes to that mm-hmm. stuff. It's just simply about it. It's like, I'm a person you can talk to where, you know, having a different opinion is not going to come back on
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And they learn that, because the secret to my success is them being comfortable with me. And this is all kinds of people, engineers, executives, mm-hmm. design people, you name it. But if they think there's going to be a problem with something, I want them to tell me.
Yeah, you do.
Right. And then, you know, if I know about it, then we can address it.
And I did make it a point at a lot of them where I'm doing a team lunch on Friday, but I always try to tell people, like when my first assistant started and then when this next one started, I make mistakes all the time and I'll tell, like, hey, I made this mistake. And just to be honest about it, because it's just part of life. And right. these jobs yep. are really difficult. There's all kinds of things that happen that you've never seen before. You can be working in the field for 30 years and you'll come across something that you've not seen before in a home.
Right.
You know, or weird forces collide. Like, we have a windstorm now and I'm worried about this one job site that we've got in Denver. Like, there's things that happen that might be your fault, but you got to say it and not try to cover it up mm-hmm. because we all do. And it's so much better just to say, oh man, I messed that up. Yeah. So if I could write a whole book about things that I've messed up.
So when I started out working for IBM, I was overworking in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I spent time with it. I hung out with people from all over Europe, all over the world. Mm-hmm. And there was a Scottish guy with a thick Scottish accent, Ian McDonald.
Oh, what a great
Ian
name.
Ian McDonald.
And so we were out drinking, you know, after like in some trade conference.
Whoa, Scottish guy yep. drinking? Yep. Come on.
Huh. And so Ian said, well, when I started working, my dad gave me this advice. And he said, Ian, my son, if you make a mistake at work, go out in the hallway and shout up and down, I fucked up. I fucked up.
That's funny.
And then then he says, and if you find yourself in the hall too often, it's time to look for a new job.
That's true.
So he was Irish.
That
then.
Is true.
Well, yeah. yeah
That's yeah. funny. Yeah.
But that's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's good advice. I like that.
I like that too. That's there really are good. In my job, there are so many different ways to mess up. And some of the screw ups, like, I won't know I've made a mistake until 6 months after that mistake was made. And it goes for the people I work with too. Like, I don't know, different things. Like my cabinet guy, we ordered a cabinet that wouldn't turn in the hallway. But he didn't learn that until 12 weeks after the cabinets were ordered. And then the guy's like, I think I need to cut this cabinet in half so I can get it to make the turn.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And there's just things like that mm-hmm. that just, yeah. But Andrew, how have you been?
You know, it's been busy too. So I manage my own business. I work full time. You know, I've got the family, and there's times when, it's just a lot, and I can't get to everything.
No.
But you know, it's just this time of year is typically busy. So my oldest son Dash will turn 13 this last week.
That's right. Happy birthday to
Dash.
So a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And so we asked him, like, well, what do you want to do for your birthday? Because 13, right?
Yeah, big number.
So, you know, he basically said, well, I want to take two of my best friends, my two best friends from school. I want to take them to a Japanese restaurant.
Oh.
So, of course, he picks the most expensive Japanese restaurant in Denver.
He is your son, Andrew.
Right?
That's right.
Actually, sorry. He's Katie's son.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. And so... It's a restaurant called Matsuhisa, which is
I wondered where they were. Katie posted pictures of the cute kids.
Yeah,
on,
and so
okay,
the restaurant's in Cherry Creek. It is created by the same person who created Nobu.
Oh wow!
Whoa!
Right. So that's the class we're talking.
I hear you.
And so, you know, it was exciting.
So he's been there before then.
No,
How did he find out about this? Did he Google most expensive restaurant
because
in Denver?
He knows that mom and dad goes there, and he's been he's been to Nobu before.
In New York?
When we were in Hawaii.
Oh, in Hawaii. Oh, there's Nobu in Hawaii.
Right.
Oh.
Right. And so we went to Nobu twice.
Wow.
Right? So, in any case.
As one does.
Why wouldn't you? Why go once when you can go twice?
It was fun to introduce, like, to see the kids. And so the kids, like, order, like, oh, yeah. I want a water. I'm like, I told the waiter, I said, hang on a second here.
Yeah.
I'm like, don't you guys have mocktails? And the waiter's, oh, yeah. We've got mocktails.
Oh, fun.
And so then he rattles them off, and the kids are all like, yeah, I'll take that one. I'll take that one.
So
one
fun.
Of the pictures is the kids holding up the mocktails.
I want a mocktail.
Right? It's like,
I'm starving now.
Yeah.
You can't just have a glass of water. No.
No.
And then, you know, the food there, all the food is really just an explosion of creativity and flavor.
Wow.
Right? I mean, just unbelievable food. And I won't go into too much detail. But it was fun watching these kids discover the food. And we ordered...
How did the boys handle it?
Great.
That's good.
And... you know, he made sure his friends like sushi.
Yeah, that's a good idea before you go.
And the one kid, his sister's allergic to everything.
Ooh.
So he can't eat seafood and stuff like that because,
at home.
Because of allergies at home. So, right? It's a great thing for him.
Good.
And then the other guy, his dad actually owns a restaurant or two in town.
Wow.
Right? And so his parents were...
Oh, really?
Yeah. So his parents were, you're going to Matsuhisa. He's like, that, you know, that's probably going to be the most expensive meal you've ever eaten. And it probably was.
But he's a kid who's exposed to different kinds of
food. Yeah. And so...
That's cool.
You know, so, you know, we ordered the Wagyu beef, and they have like this hot stone, and you cook these little slivers of beef on there.
Wow.
So Wagyu beef, that's like the most expensive beef.
Grade A Wagyu. Yeah.
I don't know.
It's like melts in your mouth like butter.
Known for being...
I'm glad you told me because I literally have no idea.
The best beef.
You know how I am.
So for the five of us, we ordered 4 ounces of Wagyu.
Where's the beef?
Four ounces.
Okay.
Four ounces. All right.
Now, what do you think it costs for 4 ounces of Wagyu?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know the first thing about... You've had steak most recently in Vegas, Steve.
Yeah, I don't even know what size.
You know, 4 ounces is
small.
What's
it's a mignon?
Small, right?
That's a mignon, isn't it?
It's smaller than that.
Smaller
than
a mignon.
Like a small fillet is an 8 ounce fillet is a small fillet.
Ooh, so we're talking a tiny, like the size of like a. What are you like?
I can show you pictures.
Like a silver dollar pancake, like the size of that.
Not even that. It's maybe 10 little slivers.
$50.
Well, that's $160 plus tax and gratuities for 4 ounces of Wagyu.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Right?
Wow.
Yeah, boy. Well, they saw you coming. Now, was it good?
Oh, no. I mean, it's
melts in your mouth. Is it worth
amazing.
$160?
It's not like, you know, it's not like any steak you've ever had before.
Yeah.
You don't order that well done, do you?
Well, no, it's
raw.
You cook it on the stone.
You got to cook it?
Yeah, they make you cook it, too.
Oh,
they don't cook it for
man.
You.
So, why do the most expensive places make it a melting pot? Why do the most expensive places make you do all the cooking?
It's fun. Something to do.
And so then, you know, for dessert, we ordered literally, well, I should say, so then we also ordered this, the one guy's like, oh, can we have salmon? And it's like, oh, we can, you know, order a salmon roll. And so we order a salmon roll, and... The one kid was just like popping these pieces of salmon in his mouth.
Oh,
like,
and you're like,
one,
slow down.
One
kid,
after,
slow
one
down.
After he's like, are you going to eat that last piece? Are you going to eat that last piece?
Wow.
But, you know, it was probably the greatest thing he's ever eaten. But just to see the kids' excitement.
What was
the food,
dessert? I'm curious.
So we ordered every dessert on there, and they had like some.
Like, what a nice treat.
Like 4 different flavors of like this mochi ice.
Ooh.
We ordered the Japanese version of shaved ice.
Hmm.
Right? And I really had like a butterscotch sauce poured, like two different sauces, like a cream and a butterscotch poured over top with like ice cream, butter, something ice cream
that
down at the bottom.
Good.
Molten chocolate cake, covered strawberries.
Wow.
Like we literally ordered just about every dessert on the menu. So, you know, it was a great meal. You know, the boys behaved themselves.
That's great.
You know, exceptionally well. You know, I don't even want to tell you, like, what that meal cost.
I don't want to know.
No need.
No need.
You think about, like, you know, probably about the price of a mortgage.
mortgage payment.
Like, you know, and I wasn't even drinking.
Oh,
you know.
Wow.
And we even had to stop at McDonald's on the way home and get some more food.
We didn't.
Okay. No, we didn't. Yeah.
Right. I hope not.
They are smaller portions in the nicer restaurants, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're never hungry, though. I've never been hungry from the nicer. Because it's still enough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a nice treat for Dashiell, and I'm sure he'll remember that.
You know, for his 13th birthday, and it was also something he got to share with two of his friends.
The kids, the pictures of the other two boys, they looked thrilled. They were all so absolutely excited.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting that the guy who will take his son out for a dinner like that, remember, this is the same guy who said, hey, Katie's out of town. Let me come over and bring dinner over. And then it ended up us serving him dinner.
No, I offered to buy because it's us with other people. So it's like,
is that what happened?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Otherwise, right. He's buying for our family. Yeah. And then I'm not the one who ordered because I was on a Zoom call. Dave Medicus ordered something that was inedible.
Well, I ordered something called the Jungle Curry, and it smelled like what
so
maybe...
So Dave and I shared one small
the
entree.
The bottom of your feet would smell like after walking through the jungle. Maybe they should have put...
I think there was something wrong
in the mushroom.
It was a bad mushroom.
All right, well, I'll tell you what's not bad. That is Kate Quinn's new book, The Diamond Eye. Had a great chat with Quinn, and Laurie's going to tell us just a little bit more about that book right now before we get to... our conversation with Kate.
Mm-hmm. So this is based on a true story of a quiet, bookish historian who became history's deadliest female sniper,
mm-hmm.
which is crazy to think
it
about.
It really is.
Like kind of a nerdy young woman, really
like
into
how
history,
does that happen? Mm-hmm.
And then became a sniper. So this is set in the Ukraine during World War II. During this time period, the Ukraine was a part of the Soviet Union. And Hitler's army began their invasion of Russia, of the Soviet Union, in Romania. And so they attacked from Romania and came into Ukraine.
Okay.
And it was absolutely brutal. The Ukrainians were unprepared. They were outnumbered. They were outgunned. Mm. Does any of this sound familiar?
Yeah, does it sound familiar?
Yeah. Women fought for the Soviet Union alongside men in many cases. And Mila, the sniper... was an excellent markswoman, and she became a female sniper for the Soviet Army. So this story was fascinating to read just in context with what's going on right now in this part of the world. And it helped me understand more about the Ukrainians, less about the Soviets, the Russians, more about the Ukrainians. These are really tough people.
Yeah.
And they proved it in World War II. I mean, these are fighters. Fighters. Mm-hmm. They're out-personed, outgunned, everything. They're just fighting.
Mm-hmm.
So part of this book is full on war. Descriptions of war with Mila in the trenches. She's in the trees. She's hidden on bridges. She's trying to kill German officers, you know, take down as many as she possibly could. At one point, she and some other snipers that she's in charge of, they fire on priests that are marching with the German army just to catch the other people off guard. Anything they can do because they're getting slaughtered, absolutely slaughtered. So the other part of this is based on a tour that Mila did in America to help get American sympathy for the war that the Russians were fighting against Hitler's army.
Right.
Russia wanted monetary support. From us. So on this tour, she became friends with Eleanor Roosevelt, and I really enjoyed those chapters as well.
Yeah.
Excellent story.
Some really fun stories with Kate Quinn about that, and a great conversation. Here that is for you right now. This is Kate Quinn.
No. In fact, it brings us joy.
Brings us great joy, Kate. Brings us great joy, as did your book.
Yes. Yes. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. Great book, The Diamond Eye. This book, you know, about a Ukrainian female sniper during World War II blew my socks off. I couldn't put it down. I'd never heard of Mila Pavlenchenko before. I think I'm saying that right. And I had no idea there were female snipers during World War II.
Mm-mm.
I also honestly don't really even know if there are female snipers now. I'm assuming there are. When did you first hear about her?
I happened to be doing research for my novel, The Huntress, which is the one before The Rose Code. And since that had a plot thread that dealt intensely with the Night Witches, who were the Soviet all-female regiment of night bomber pilots who flew against Hitler's Eastern Front. I happened to be suddenly reading all kinds of articles about other Soviet women war heroines. And that was because the Soviet Union was the only allied nation that put women officially in combat.
Wow.
And, you know, women were allowed to join their army, allowed to join their air force. And so suddenly I was reading about women, women night bomber pilots, women fighter pilots, women tank drivers. And I was reading about women snipers. The Soviet Union had about 2,000 of them.
Oh,
and
wow.
Only about 500 survived. Wow. That's how dangerous a job it was. Hmm. But the undisputed queen of them was Lyudmila Pavlichenko, who earned the nickname Lady Death and who had a tally of about 309. And that's only officially. We don't know. I mean, that's only
exactly.
That's only the confirmed kills. We have no idea, you know, what that number would be when you add in the fact that she was also simply fighting every day to survive. And what about the you know, the ones that were not tallied?
Yeah.
So she was quite an incredible woman. And as soon as I read about her and, you know, not only about her war record, but also about the fact that, you know, she was a single mother, she was a library researcher, an aspiring historian, and that she was sent to the United States in 1942 on a goodwill tour and became friends with Eleanor Roosevelt. You know, what a story. So I knew I wanted to write that story, and I sort of tucked it in my back pocket for further down the line. I ended up writing the Rose Code first, but after that was done, I thought, you know, this is, it's time. I want to write Lady Death's story now, although I had no idea how timely it would be.
Given I was wondering.
Came out in Ukraine. Yeah. With Ukraine's invasion, and it's the terrible news that we're reading about that, because Lyudmila Pavlichenko was Ukrainian. She did all of her fighting on Ukrainian soil in defense of Ukrainians against the Nazis. So it ended up being a bit more timely than I had in mind.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, I mean, it's an odd timing, and I had such an eerie feeling when I was reading it, and I'm sure you're hearing this from a lot of people, because, you know, I was reading this right in February, right when the Russians were beginning their invasion, and it was very strange to read about. When you first started hearing about it, what was your feeling with that, with your book, too?
First, it was simply a sensation of grief. You know, Ukraine has been through so much in their history, and they, you know, they are still going through so much, and it is horrendously unfair. The other thing that I heard about was that it did not surprise me one bit, the kind of tough, determined, ferocious, creative defense that the Ukrainian people are putting up, men and women alike, because, you know, if there's anything I learned from my research about Mila Pavlichenko, it is do not underestimate the toughness of Ukrainians, especially Ukrainian women.
You're right. And as I was reading, I was like, oh, no wonder they're fighting. No wonder.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They know how to do this. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've done that before. I mean, Mila in her day, she was fighting for the Red Army, and, you know, the Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union at the time. But it wasn't a matter of, you know, I'm fighting for Stalin or I'm fighting for communism. It was a matter of Hitler's armies are pouring over Ukraine's borders. And she understood very clearly that this is a war of self-defense. This is a war of an aggressor coming into your homeland, wanting to destroy you because you and your countrymen are undesirables racially and deserve to be put down. And she understood very well that if people like her did not fight, that then her son, who was only about 9 years old at the time, would grow up in the Hitler Youth learning how to Sieg Heil. And that was unacceptable to her. And that was why she fought.
Wow.
Yeah. And your descriptions of the fighting at the Russian front are just dark, brutal, devastating. And this was just a slaughter at the start of Germany's advance. Did you do anything to prepare for writing these scenes? Do you watch movies? Do you read other books? Do you look at news footage? Do you pick up did you pick up a sniper rifle while you were writing this book?
Yes, I did. I actually own a Mosin Nagant with PE sights, which is exactly the weapon that Lyudmila Pavlichenko fired. It's easy to have. Those were made by millions, so it wasn't like I had to go out and buy something that was rare.
Didn't have to get on eBay or the dark web. Okay, that's good.
No, it was. They're very common out there.
Okay.
And so I did pick that up, and I did learn how to shoot it. Oh, and cool. I was able to learn things right away, like the fact that it is a heavy piece of equipment. And I was thinking immediately, my God, this woman must have been made of iron.
She was tiny.
And all of her equipment around.
Wow.
And the fact that it's a very simple bolt action. And that's, I immediately thought this is the kind of thing you can operate in cold weather with heavy gloves, which is exactly what you need mm-hmm. on the Eastern Front when the weather is, you know, absolutely brutal. And, you know, the fighting was brutal there, you know, because the army was, you know, horrendously under equipped.
Yeah.
There was unfortunately that terrible order of, you know, not one step back, which meant that the Russian soldiers, the Soviet soldiers could be shot by their own officers for if they were perceived to be falling back in any way. Mm. And really the whole thing was falling back because, you know, for all the posturing about not one step back, you know, they were pushed back hard on their back feet and they were unprepared and they had really no recourse but to mount a fighting retreat and let the vastness of the land and the brutality of the weather due to Hitler, what it did to Napoleon.
Wow.
And that is exactly what it did. Because really, it was the exact same mistake. The Russian front, it was too big. It's too vast. It's too brutal. It's too cold to be held by an invader. And Hitler learned that message just the way Napoleon did.
Wow.
Were you a good shot? Are you a good shot?
Oh, yeah. Good question.
Come on. You can't.
I'm not terrible, but I'm no Mila Popovich.
Well, you probably didn't practice. I imagine you got it. You got what you needed out of it. It sounds to me like this is why you go out and buy the. If you're going to write about this, you got to experience it. You got to be somewhat of a method writer. You get out there and immediately it sounds like you learn from it. So why practice? Practice your writing, you know, not your.
Well, I probably would have done more with it if I'd been able to, but we're also in the middle of lockdown. So going to a range was one of those things a little difficult right now. So
that's
I did what I could and, you know, tried to learn what I could from it, which was. I wanted to learn what the heft was. I wanted to learn, you know, what does it feel like to be able to be lining a shot up? What does it feel like, you know, to be methodically reloading? Mm-hmm. How many shots is it? You know, can you load in there? 5. And, you know, something like, what does it feel like, you know, to fight eye fatigue? And the fact is that, you know, a sniper does actually not close one eye. You just let your dominant eye take over. And, you know, what does it feel like when eye fatigue does start to pop up? Things like that. You know, that's the kind of thing that I want to, you know, understand so I can write about it a bit better. And, you know, it's not always possible. You know, method acting is a great thing, you know, but method writing, you know, as well, you do what you can for the sake of research, but you can't always, you know, do everything that you'd like to because, you know, budget or time or practicality, or in this case, you know, since this was a book written entirely during lockdown, you know, that certainly had it threw its complications into the writing process.
Yeah.
And I can't help every time I hear bolt action sniper rifle, of course, I think of Lee Harvey Oswald. And you know the rifle he allegedly used to shoot JFK, but did you speak to any real life snipers as you were preparing doing your research for this one?
I did have some professionals do some beta reading of my first draft to make sure that the gun stuff was coming across as realistically as possible. And that was actually, it was great. I learned a lot from them and they gave me a lot of really great tips about like, well, you wouldn't really call it this. You should call it that. And I don't think he would be doing this. He'd probably be doing that. And that was a lot of really good feedback.
Wow. That sniper stuff that was in there with the Sniper's Nest and Kostya, it was fascinating.
Yeah.
And just thinking about them looking for other spots, like where would you hit? Where would you sit? Have you, when you started reading and getting into that, were you starting to walk around you in your day-to-day life looking around?
Where would make a good nest?
Well, I'm a little bit aware of that anyway, because, you know, I'm a military wife. My husband's in the Navy, and so I know a lot of military people, men and women. And there is a thing that, you know, I already know people who absolutely will not sit with their back to an open door, or, you know, they absolutely, when they walk into a room, they know what the exits are, they know what the lines of sight are, and they want to sit with the best view of the room that they have so that nobody can come up behind them or get the drop on them. And I already know people like that. So that's not a surprise.
It's day-to-day life for you. Yeah, that's really funny. You have a line, it's early on in the book, and it kind of broke my heart about Mila, Ludmila, where she says, quote, "I won't miss again, not ever." And this is something about her as a markswoman, but it's also about her, you know, as a mom and as a human being. And I just thought, oh, that's awful. That's so hard. And I thought that was an interesting theme that you would see almost throughout her life. She was so hard on herself. Do you think that she was, or were you projecting on her? How did you kind of get that from her, that perfectionism? Yeah.
Well, I think you have to have a streak of that if you're going to be a sniper, because you have to be patient and exacting, and you need to be, you know, aware, you know, like for a sniper, you know, when you miss by this much, that could be a clean miss. You know, these are people who, you know, bullseyes are a way of life for them. So that is a certain level of perfectionism that's just built in. And it also was something that really became something I wanted to emphasize, because it seems to me, and you know, when I was writing about Mila, is that one thing that worried me was that I want her to be relatable to the ordinary reader. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned that the ordinary reader would not find her relatable. Mm-hmm. I find her intensely relatable because, you know, to me, she's not just this, you know, icy James Bond, you know, caricature, you know, with, you know, steely eyes and, you know, this, you know, the kill list next to her heart. You know, she was a single mother. She was a bookworm. She was a nerd who could geek out over history trivia.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had, you know, intensely relatable dreams. And the thing that made me think about, you know, why perfectionism would be sort of like the drumbeat that she uses, you know, to sort of punish herself as well as to exceed, is that I think women are especially inclined to flog themselves to be perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, we're expected to be perfect wives, perfect mothers, perfect hubs of the family, also expected to kill it at work. You know, we're expected to do everything. And I know so many women who are so hard on themselves to be perfect, and they beat themselves up so much if they fail. And it seemed to me that this is something intensely relatable, that all women readers can relate to, is the idea that, you know, there is that perfectionism that makes you so tough on yourself. And I remember it really struck me when it was a Twitter discussion, you know, in the book world on Twitter. And someone said, it was, tell us what your book about, and then tell us what your book's really about. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, book's about a World War II story of, you know, the most effective female sniper in history. And then I was like, what is the book really about? It's really about how women especially can embrace crushing levels of perfectionism while swallowing ungodly amounts of rage, and how that makes them professionally successful, yet personally and emotionally unbelievably stressed.
Yeah.
And so really,
wow.
Once I kind of nailed that down for myself, I thought, all right, well, that's really going to be the thing that she has to learn in this book, is that she already is someone who has made a mistake in her life, as she views it. She became pregnant as a teenager. You know, she loves her son, but that's the kind of thing that really derails a woman's life if she's not careful. She thinks, I can never make a mistake like that again. And then she gets into sharpshooting, where the tiniest mistake could mean death for herself or for the people she loves and leads. And so that perfectionism is just ramped up even more. And then what she has to learn is, how can I, you know, accept the fact that I'm not always going to hit everything? How can I accept the fact and live with the fact that you can't always be perfect?
Yes.
And that's a hard lesson for her to learn. And that's ultimately what she will learn with the help of friends like Eleanor Roosevelt, who knows a little thing or two about very high expectations
sure.
for women.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. It made me sad for her too, reading that, just because it's familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's familiar.
Now, Kate, I read that almost every person named in your novel, quote, comes straight from the historical record. Is that something you set out to do? Is that important to you to kind of give a name to these people, to keep them as real as possible?
Yeah, I did want to make sure that I used the real names and, you know, fleshed out the real people as much as I could. And it was really such a gift having Ludmilla's memoir, because she does talk about, you know, the people she led who were, you know, part of her daily life and her world. Mm. And so I really found I didn't have to do a lot of invention there. You know, I did some, you know, because there's gaps in the record, or sometimes, you know, she might mention someone, but she doesn't mention what happened to them. So I have to figure out, you know, well, what fate do I think they had? But But, you know, she does mention she had a friend who was, you know, another woman who was in the medical battalion. She had, you know, a superior officer who was not only very kind, but was, and, you know, very supportive of her, but, you know, tended to be very good to the women in his battalion and tried to shield them from sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. She talks about her partner and, you know, how close they were and how she knew everything about him all the way up to, you know, like, what are his favorite, you know, his favorite snack, which is, you know, canned sardines. And she talked about, the people she met when she was on tour. And so it was a lot of fun to go with that, because, you know, she really did meet an extraordinary number of people in her, you know, very wide and well-traveled life. And so I really just had to bring to life the people that she was already talking about.
And you don't try to, so it would seem to me, like, as an author, it would be difficult for me not to just start to embellish and just go crazy with the facts and, facts
why you're not an
get
author.
In the way of a good story. That is true. But it sounds like that's not too easy. Way you seem to see it as you're just kind of trying to prop your characters up and stay true to them. It doesn't seem to me to be something that you struggle with.
No, it's a balance that you always look for. You know, where do you fictionalize and where do you hew strictly to the truth? I don't mind fictionalizing because, you know, I am a novelist. I'm not a nonfiction author. I'm certainly not a historian. So therefore, you know, I had fun layering in an assassination attempt into this book, which historically did not happen. But on the other hand, I think it could have.
Yeah.
Because plenty of assassination attempts on presidents are never reported and never make it to the headlines. And the fact was, is that FDR historically was nearly assassinated once, and also survived a nonviolent coup that was intending to replace him with a military leader. And that coup was basically folded up and swept away and dealt with very privately in the corridors of power. But it allegedly involved some of the, you know, biggest names in American industry. I mean, this was a president who had enemies. And I thought, you know, I'm going to use that, and I'm going to fictionalize a threat to his life that is going to happen while Mila is on American soil. Because really, if you're going to make an attempt on a president's life, don't you do it when there's a Russian sniper in town?
That's when it happens.
Yes, exactly. You do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And her friendship with Eleanor Roosevelt was really interesting, and, you know, based on historical record too. Mm-hmm. And I love the scene where Eleanor is driving Mila through the streets of Washington, D.C. So just the first lady and this Russian sniper together, like tearing through the streets in Eleanor's little car. I mean, can you imagine? Wouldn't it have been wonderful to have, like, looked at them and seen them go by?
Yeah.
Like, what a story.
Yes, and that was really one of those things I would not have dared to make up, speaking of things that you fictionalize and things that you don't. But it really, there are a few scenes that came right from Mila's memoir that I was so delighted by, you know, one being that one. You know, really, it was their first day of knowing each other, and Eleanor offered to give Mila a ride to, you know, there was going to be a dinner party in D.C. that night. And, you know, Lady Death, who was not frightened by much, was apparently just appalled by the first lady's driving and was like sitting there clutching the door of this little two-seater convertible as, you know, Eleanor is bulleting through the night.
Oh, it's really funny.
So that was a fun one. And then there was another one about how Eleanor was sort of her guide and her, you know, cheerleader in her corner when they went on the Goodwill tour and was, you know, pointing out, you know, this is my country. I want to show it to you. And then there was a fun bit when, you know, Mila was invited to be a guest at the Roosevelt Hudson Estate in New York. And she went out on a canoe and fell into the water and came out, you know, dripping wet. And the first lady, much like, you know, moms everywhere, is like, you are going to catch your death of cold. Get in here, young lady. And, you know, then and FDR, you know, came in later and just literally found his wife and the Ukrainian sniper sitting there on the bed, and Eleanor is hemming a pair of pajamas for Mila, who is like wrapped in towels. And he's just, you know, thinking, like, this is just one of those scenes that just defies description.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that really came from Mila's memoir. And I was just like, all right, that's just too good.
That is right. No, you
awesome.
Gotta use that.
I wish there was a photograph of that moment, too.
You need to get a photograph.
Well, there was a picture that I did find, not of that moment, but it was a wonderful picture of Eleanor and Ludmila, and the two of them are standing next to a stage, clearly ready to go on stage for some event together. And, you know, Eleanor is about a head taller than Mila is. She's a very tall woman, and she's got her head bent down, and the two of them are practically giggling, like they're clearly sharing a joke of some kind right before they go on stage and, you know, become very serious and official. And as soon as I saw that picture, I thought, no, they really were friends. You can tell. It's all over the body language.
That's cool.
And then, you know, towards the end of your book, I'm not giving anything away, but you also talk a lot about, or not a lot, you mentioned Franklin's women. And I thought that was an interesting way of putting it. And I'd never really thought about it. There's a lot I don't know. And I hadn't really realized, but he did collect in a way, smart, intelligent, unusual for that time in that they were maybe in roles of power that maybe women didn't often have that worked for Franklin.
He did. He had a liking for, you know, smart women, and he certainly used them where he could. I mean, Eleanor was pushed way out of her comfort zone in a way to be his, what she was termed as his eyes, his ears, and his legs. Mm. She went the places where he could not to give him the information that he couldn't go collect for himself. And, you know, it's true too that she pushed him. She was his conscience. She was someone who did not shut up about things like, Franklin, I know you got a war to fight, but we also have to think about civil rights, because if we don't save this, if we save this country, but then lose the soul in the process, what are we saving it for? Mm-hmm. And he would groan, but he would listen to her. And then you had women like Missy LaHand, who was his personal secretary, who was an incredibly powerful woman in the Washington halls of power. You had Frances Perkins, who was coming, actually going to get a book of her own. My friend Stephanie Dre is writing Madam Secretary as we speak.
Oh, yeah. Great.
She was the first woman on the cabinet and, you know, his labor secretary. And, you know, that really she was the genius behind the New Deal.
Oh.
And, you know, it was women who were all part of his life and who were, you know, he did not underestimate whose talents he used. And that was, you know, I think a little something that I wanted to throw in there because, you know, to make it clear, it was not out of character for him to, you know, look at someone like Mila Pavlichenko and think, I wonder if I can use you, you know, in a way. And he did, because, you know, it was by White House invitation that not only did they host, you know, the Soviet delegation, but, you know, they sponsored this tour around America afterwards so she could speak and, you know, talk about, please send aid to my country. My country needs it if we're going to defeat Hitler. And who knows how much of an effect that had, because, well, America did end up sending aid, and the tour did have its part in pulling American opinion around to, okay, well, we are already fighting a war with Japan, but we're going to need to fight Hitler as well. And we're going to have to send aid to those who already are.
Yeah.
So, it, you know, that was one of those things, who knows what kind of historical tipping point that could have been. You know, it's hard to estimate, you know, how much influence did, you know, this or that really have. But I think it certainly had some.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's fascinating. You also have a quote in here that kind of hung up in my head a little bit. And I was kind of curious because I thought, well, is that right? Maybe that is right. And it's something that Mila says, and she thinks this, you know, she's a good communist and she's, you know, Ukrainian, but she identifies as Russian or Soviet. And she thinks, quote, Americans want to like other people. And I thought, huh. I know in general that's true for me. Mm-hmm. When I meet somebody, I want them to like me and I want to know them and like them. Do you think that is something that Americans do initially? I know we are famous for not liking people that are different, but do you think we initially try to like other people more than other cultures maybe?
I can't make a judgment about other cultures, but I do think it is something that we do like. We want to like people and we want to be liked as well. Because it's something that I hear a lot when I talked with other authors is likability. You know, are people going to like your heroine? Are they going to like, is she likable enough? And that can be the kind of thing that can be annoying, because it's like what you don't find, you know, it's like you don't find somebody likable. Well, you can still root for them, or you can still support them.
Interesting.
I think though Americans are a bit hung up on likability. We want to be liked. We want to be the person who's, you know, has friends, and we think of ourselves as likable, and that's why we look for it in others. So I do think that is, I do think that's a bit of an American trait.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I was thinking about that recently.
Yeah, very recently, in fact, because we had a very likable guy walk up on stage and smack Chris Rock in the face. Where do you fall down on that?
Well, I have no clue. That's one of those things that's like, well, clearly emotions were running high.
Running high. Getting a little hot, a little heated.
Guess what? Yeah, okay. He's human. Mm. He's an actor, okay. You know.
No need to hit the comedian in the face, my opinion. Kate,
we all make mistakes.
What have you been binging? You've been watching, speaking of the movies, you've been watching any good TV shows? What have you been watching recently?
Well, I recently binged Yellow Jackets, an all-female soccer team that is crash lands in the wilderness and survives there for 18 months. But what did they do to survive?
Oh. This is the question.
Great writing, great characters. Now, of course, like everyone else in America, I'm watching Bridgerton, which is fluffy and beautiful and happy. And it makes me very happy.
Oh, he's going away this weekend, and I am very excited to sit and watch it.
That's right. You can have all your Bridgerton to yourself.
That's really funny. Thank you. And have you, what kind of books are you reading right now? What are you currently into?
Oh, goodness. I've been reading so many good things. I just went away to PLA, one of the big library events. I walked away with Vanessa Riley's newest, which is about the some real life heroines of the Haitian Revolution. Mm. I am soon going to be reading my friend Stephanie Dry's Madam Secretary about Frances Perkins, since I'm one of her beta readers and critique partners.
Very good. Awesome. All right.
I've been enjoying some of the contemporary romances by Jane Igaro, which are wonderful because they're not only about romance, but they're about culture. Nigerian women who are trying to find the balance between Nigerian culture and their own culture as Canadians or as Americans.
Wow.
And I've really been enjoying those as well. So, so many good books lately.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
You're right about World War II and that time in history. Do you have any movies that you like? Any World War II movies? Inglourious Basterds. Are you a big Inglourious Bastards fan? Is really
that's
what
actually
I'm
one
about.
I have never seen.
What?
I don't know why that is. It's on the list. I just haven't seen it. As far as the World War II movies go, actually one that I have always loved back since when I saw it in college was Enemy at the Gates, which is about a Soviet sniper.
Another one
played by Jude Law.
Oh.
And it's a wonderful film, and it has great stuff about sniping and about the whole business of it. So I'd say really my sort of interest in snipers and their mentality was seeded rather early because of that, because it makes it very clear, you know, this is one of the few jobs in wartime that is not helped by adrenaline, because you have to be cool calm and quiet and still under unbelievable pressure, rather than counting on adrenaline to get you, you know, to power you through something. And I immediately ended up thinking, well, what kind of mindset does that take? You know, who is it who can succeed at that? And, you know, when I started reading Lyudmila Pavlyuchenko's memoir, I think I got a better understanding of that.
Mm. Interesting.
It's like those biathletes, you know, in the Winter Olympics who race around the cross-country skis, and they got to slow the heartbeat down and shoot the targets. Well, Kay, listen, thank you so much for joining us. We loved your book, The Diamond Eye.
Excellent. And, couldn't put it down, and it was so unfortunately timely also.
Yeah.
But absolutely. It is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
You got always great Kate. Chatting with you, Kate.
Happy
Take
pump
care.
Day.
Yes, happy pump day.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, there you go. Thank you so much to Kate Quinn. Check out her new book, The Diamond Eye, and you will not be disappointed. Let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews.
And let's start with all right, Laura, what have you for us this week?
I have a book called Dear Edward. It's by Anne Napolitano, maybe? Let's go with that. Napolitano. So this is a rave for me. Absolute rave.
Oh, a rave.
Yes.
Okay, that gives you...
Yeah, you get a yeah boy.
This is a yeah boy. So I missed this book when it came out. It came out in January of 2020, right before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I was yammering on about how we all needed to buy toilet paper. I was getting prepared. I prepared early and then I forgot.
Right.
So you can go back and listen to that. So this is fiction, and it's the story of a 12-year-old boy named Eddie, who is the sole survivor of a plane crash, a large jet crash. Mm. Specifically. So the plane.
Oh, this is the book you were reading as I was boarding a plane and you didn't want to tell me about it. Yeah.
And now I had fear in my heart. All right. So this plane crashed in Colorado on its way from. I know, yeah. Dave. I know. I didn't say a word to you. I literally was like, oh, I want to tell him so bad what I'm reading as I can't. I'm
glad you did not.
I know. So it crashed in Colorado. It was on its way from New York to LA. Eddie was on board with his parents and his older brother. And this book is so thoughtful. It's a very quiet book and it's very beautiful in the way it's written. It's mostly interior thoughts, just thoughts.
Oh, wow.
From Eddie as he moves through middle and high school without his family, just carrying the weight of this tragedy. So this book also dives into the interior lives of his aunt and uncle who take him in after the crash. And the story is framed, it's framed a little bit like a thriller, which I think made it very fast paced for me to read, but it's not a thriller. Mm. So it flashes back from present day Edward, he wants to be known Edward after the crash, to the crash day, with thoughts from a few key people that Eddie and his family interact with on the airplane. You get thoughts from his parents, thoughts from his 15-year-old brother, just the interior things as they're all boarding this plane. And Eddie's relationship with his older brother is just so moving. Mm. And it's something that is just ongoing for him. Even after the death of his brother, it's still a relationship that's there for him. So it's a really unique book. It shows building blocks just on how to survive a tragedy like this. Mentally, I mean, emotionally. Mm-hmm. And it's also just oddly reassuring, but also incredibly sad at the same time. Wow. So there's not a ton of dialogue, but it was enough there to keep the story moving. I never found the story boring, mm-hmm. which is interesting when there's so much about people thinking and what they're thinking. It's wild. I don't know how the author did it. I'd like to read more books like this, and I'm trying to think of a book to compare it to with all that interior thought, and I can't think of one that I've read. So the present day story, it takes you with Edward up to graduating high school. So he starts as a 12-year-old when you first meet him, and then he goes to 18. And then the flashbacks alternate kind of chapters, and the flashbacks lead from the flight loading. So you follow the different people to the actual crash. I couldn't put this book down, but at the same time, I wanted to savor it as much as possible. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. It's called Dear Edward.
All right. Sounds good. And you really went on and on about that one earlier
to me.
I know how much you love this one.
Yeah. And it's funny, too, because you know how when you board certain flights, you do remember like the people that are sitting around you because you're on that little contraption for so long.
Yeah.
Like you notice like, oh, they went to the bathroom or this person fell asleep or that person didn't. So it's different things that Eddie knew or noticed. So it's the people that he noticed and you hear, or maybe his mom sat next to someone else because it was three to a thing in their family of four. And it's just fascinating. Huh. Yeah.
You think the author was like on a plane when he was thinking about this book and like
she
imagining she based, all these people dying?
No, but she based it on, I think it was an Africa Airways flight where I think a big, big flight. And one boy from the Netherlands survived.
Oh, wow.
And then there was another flight, an Air France flight, where one person survived.
Man.
Yeah.
It's nice to find a book that's different.
It's different. You know?
Yeah, it is.
Especially mm-hmm. as yeah. much as we read.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's just refreshing.
Yeah.
Yep.
And, yeah.
But sometimes you find it's good different.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you find it's
that
like,
is true.
It's like, yeah, that experiment didn't work.
And before I found this one, I had stopped and started so many books, I can't even keep track of them.
It happens. That's why we're here for you, listener. We're here to give you the good books.
True. But, you know, something that I love, you know, if you think, oh, that's not for me, it might not be for you.
It's all subjective.
Yeah.
Our pain, your gain.
There you go. All right. And that book is recommended by
Laura Medicus.
And my book this week,
Dave Medicus.
is called No Second Chance, and this is by Rio Ewers, Y-O-U-E-R-S, Rio Ewers. And I recommend another book by this guy. He was an audiobook pick for me called Lola on Fire. And as much as
I remember that.
Yeah, as much as I enjoyed that one, I enjoyed this one even more. No Second Chance. This is a rip-roaring thriller with high stakes and high tension set against the backdrop of Hollywood glamour, glitz, and wannabes, what's not to love. So this is a story that tells the tale of a washed-up actor named Luke Kingsley. Once a Hollywood star, a hot Hollywood star, but then his wife disappeared. His wife, who he had a kind of a tempestuous public relationship with anyway, and then one night she disappears and his shirt that he was wearing was found to have blood on it. So everyone assumed that he killed him or killed her, although there was no body ever found. He was never proven guilty, but everyone, you know, his career went in the tank. And in fact, there is a detective in this book, a PI now, who is just certain that Luke killed his wife and is out to prove him wrong. Even though Luke says it was somebody with a face like a bat who did it. So really interesting. Now, across the street from him is a young wannabe starlet from Kentucky named Kitty Ray. Now, Kitty Ray is having more luck with her career running drugs than any acting career, and she deals in a drug called Canary, which is kind of like a meth-like drug, only it's for the rich and famous. And there's a great scene at a party where she goes with the drugs to this party, and it's like a Bret Easton Ellis scene from Glamorama, where he's talking about all these stars who were there and name-dropping all these stars as she's bringing the drugs to the party. Now, Kitty runs into a little trouble in the drug-running game and ends up teaming up with Luke to do battle against her insanely violent and cruel crime boss, Johan, known as the Viking due to this big axe he carries with him, and he's not afraid to use it. And this is a really unique, speaking of unique, this guy is a hell of a bad guy. You want to have, you know, in your books, like thrillers like this, you want to have a different bad guy. You want to have a bad guy who's got a little personality to him, and this guy does.
So now, is this a double-sided axe? Is it like, is it just an axe, or does it have like a pike on one end?
Oh, well, you'll just have to read the book and find out. That's code for me saying I don't remember. For savvy listeners out there. You know, it's an axe. It's a Viking axe. Sometimes, you know, I don't get all the details. I'm sure the author described it in great detail. Maybe I didn't pay attention to that.
You know, there's a lot of sophistication about axes. Like, you know, so there's a double-headed sided axe. And do you know why there's two sides of a double-sided axe?
So you can get them on the way back and the way, I don't know.
No, and so there's the one side, which is the dull side. And so basically, like, you do your initial swing with the sharp side of the axe, but you don't take it all the way through. And the other side is the dull side, that after you start the split, you use that one to drive it to the ground. Right? And so that's why you've got, I mean, you know, there's all these technicalities.
I'll go back and, you know, I'll go back and reread it this week and come back with an update for you guys for next week. So this is violent. It is bloody. It is gory. In other words, it's all the things that I love in a thriller, including the fast pace. It's one you're going to have a hard time putting down. Check it out for a great thrill ride you won't soon forget. Great set pieces in this one. A lot of humor, an interesting bad guy, something for everybody. This is No Second Chance by Rio Ewers. Check it out. All right, and that book is recommend. I'm sorry. It is No Second Chances. Second Chances. There you go. Boy, I got all kinds of things wrong with that review. Apologize to Rio Ewers. Check it out. That's recommended by me,
Dave Medicus.
Andrew, what do you have for us?
So I have a new Lawrence Donner's book.
Oh.
And it's been a while since I've read anything
him. It's been a while since you recommended Lawrence Donner's, Larry Donner's.
Yep. It is part of the Time Flow series, or Time Flow Stories. And this book is called Fast Times at Altamont High.
Nice.
Oh, right. All right. Okay.
And what you will not find in this book is any awkward bathroom scenes. So Okay.
I'm thinking of the movie.
And there's no... There's
I don't remember.
Oh, that... Okay.
Yeah, and there's
okay.
no... no need to go. There's no pizza sharing in this book either.
Okay. Okay. All right.
So you know, I must have no memory of that movie. Isn't that funny?
This is a movie with Jeff Spicoli where Jeff orders the pizza in the classroom.
Yeah.
And the professor is like... Yes, yes, yes.
Well, Mr. Spicoli, that is our time. Therefore, it is our pizza. And then he proceeds to hand out... Mr. Spicoli's pizza to the classroom.
That's right.
A classic.
And everybody gets a piece except for Jeff Spicoli.
Yep.
Yeah. Oh, you okay there, Dave?
Dave's looking for us.
I thought I know I have a Spicoli soundbite somewhere on this soundboard, but you know, it'd be nice if you could look up where they are, but you just can't. So I'm just staring at a bunch of colored squares trying to find it. So you can continue on with yours, and I'll see if I can find that clip for you.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I love Lawrence Dunner's books is they're enjoyable. They are, you know, somewhat believable. Like, it's not like so ridiculously far-fetched. And what he does is he takes reality, and then he'll create like a little scientific twist, right? And then he basically just follows that premise through, and he creates a whole, you know, a whole story universe around that. And so the main character in this book is Whit Ryland. He is a high school student. I don't know if he's a sophomore or, you know, a junior, probably like a junior.
Mm-hmm.
And he is really an unlikely hero. He is smart. His family is struggling financially. He has a sister. He has a mom. His mom is a single mom. His sister is completely spoiled, you know, doesn't appreciate anything. And, you know, their family is so troubled that they're living in a small house, and his mom's like, I can't make the ends meet. We're going to have to move into an even smaller place where, you know, like a studio apartment where, you know, he's going to have to sleep on the couch, you know, and the, you know, where they have to get their cell phones cut off. I mean, so they're really struggling as a family, but Whit is very smart. He is a nice kid. And of course it comes into a situation where he is being bullied at school. Right. And it comes down to it is there is a, popular girl at school that wants to that is talking to Whit because she knows he's really good at math, and she needs a math tutor. And so she approaches Whit to say, do you think you could tutor me? And of course her boyfriend sees this, you know, the high school football player guy, he sees this, and so, you know, Whit knows he is about to get his ass kicked. Right. So of course, you know, this book is a lot like Spider-Man, you know, where Peter Parker gets bit by the spider and discovers, you know, he has
superpowers.
All right.
And so what Whit discovers is he discovers that he has control of time.
Oh.
And he can speed up time or slow down time. And so as Whit proceeds to get ready to beat the crap out of him, time speeds up, right? It's, you know, fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
And so he chooses flight.
Yeah.
But he does it in such a way that the bully ends up getting seriously injured.
Wow!
Right. So, you know, that's the premise of this book, and it is a very enjoyable story. Now, this book is
seems like it's funny,
and it is. It's funny. There is a serious element too, where if you know it's dealing in reality, But generally just a good, easy, fun-loving read.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if somebody actually got superpowers,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, like, if some high school kid
mm-hmm.
in reality got superpowers. Now, let's go around the room and think of a one-word adjective to describe a junior in high school.
Male or female?
Either. I mean, honestly, either. But a one-word adjective to describe what that experience is going to be like.
Oh, you mean if they got superpowers?
If it actually happened in reality.
Oh, well, I can tell you, there's only one word, that is anarchy. So as a high school teacher dealing with those kids every day, sheer and total lunacy and anarchy.
Yeah. Yeah, nightmarish.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and that's a little bit of what happens.
I thought
here.
You meant what superpower would they choose?
No.
Well, if you were a guy, I'm guessing my high school boys would go straight to invisibility.
That's what I was thinking. Girls wouldn't choose that.
No,
I don't know what they would choose, but I don't think they would choose that.
Boys would go with invisibility, guaranteed.
Yeah. And they'd all be hiding out in the
girls'
locker room,
of course,
or the boys' locker room, depending on their predilection.
Right, either or.
Yeah,
and that would last about 5 seconds. So
yes,
yeah. So basically, after the incident, everything changes. And of course, he confides in one of his friends who's less responsible to him. And of course, his friend talks him into some pretty stupid stuff. And so Whit ends up taking on some drug dealers.
Oh.
Right? And so, you know, this book really, it has it all. It is unapologetically a bumbling superhero book.
That's fun.
That's cool.
You know, it is a feel-good. You get to see some vigilante justice. You know, I'd say it's about as close to reality as you're going to get if hormonal teenagers, you know, happen to develop superpowers.
That's funny.
So the book is Fast Times at Altamont High by Lawrence Donners.
All right. Very good. And that's recommended by... Which means it's time for the audiobook of the week. And my pick this week, and speaking of unique books and different books, this is a different one. This is called Ring Shout by P. Jelly Clark. And it is narrated by Channy Waits. And this is a novel that really blends real life historical facts with fantasy elements. In fact, in essence, what it does is turns the KKK into monsters. So this is, I mean, obviously monsters.
I understand what you're saying.
Anyway, but they turn them into literal monsters. So as the book said in 19...
That's a good idea.
Oh, yeah. It's a great idea. This book said in 1920s Georgia. And what this book purports is that the movie Birth of a Nation by D.W. Griffith that has been released, it's opened up across the country, and what it has done, it has also opened up a kind of portal, and now a monster known as a Ku Klux, they are rampaging across the country. They're dressed as Klan members, but only their worst. They feed on hate so much that they turn into these literal monsters, these Ku Kluxes. And the heroes of the book are these three black women named Maurice, Chef, and Sadie. They are hunting these monsters, and they just so happen to have on their side a magical singing sword.
This sounds so good.
Oh, it really is.
I feel like this has to be made into a movie.
I would love to see this as a movie.
I can think of an ex-president that would make a great...
That's right. That is
such a great concept.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Boy.
It's different. It's unique. It's exciting. A fresh and unique take on racism in America. It's a relatively quick and short book. It's really well done. The narration is so, so good. Hmm. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Ring Shout by P. Jelly Clark. All right, there you go. That is your outstanding audiobook of the week. Check it out, Ring Shout. And that'll do it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening to episode 163. Tell a friend if you've enjoyed this show, and give us a 5-star review on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you listen to your podcast. Thanks to Kate Quinn for coming by. Check out our book, The Diamond Eye. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next week.
Adios.
Excelsior.
Hey, I'm going to push you off to the side when we hit the canyon to mile 9, and I'm going to cross the finish line first.